herself.
Thanks, Gráinne. If you're a bit confused about the programme, so am I. So Sarah Knight was meant to be speaking in this slot, and Sarah can't be here because she's not very well today. So she told me that her slides were here to speak to, but I can't find them. So I'm going to jump in and talk to my slides, which would have been in the following slot. And if Leanne shows up waving a data stick with Sarah's slides, we'll find some time to talk to Sarah's slides. But essentially, we were to speak about the same GISC programme. And in a way, it makes more sense for me to speak first, although I now have the slides, because the work that I have been doing is a retrospective review of that programme, whereas Sarah was going to speak more about taking the programme forward and where GISC is going with the findings of Design for Learning and the whole sort of Design for Learning area. So I should say straight away that my review of the Design for Learning programme is exactly that, and it doesn't take into account the work that Patrick has been speaking about and Gráinne of Cloudworks. In a sense, I think it foreshadows some of it, but really I wanted to talk about some of the dilemmas, the tensions that seem to emerge from the projects that were involved in Design for Learning over these last 3 or 4 years, and set them up really as not as problems that are unsolvable, but the problems we really need to be grappling with, and that, having said that, that I know are being grappled with in some of the work you've been hearing about today. So the Design for Learning programme was set up really to explore the convergence of technical developments like LAMS. So it's really great to be still involved with LAMS and talking to this conference. With another development, which was very much coming from the educational practice and theory side, which was what I have sort of termed elsewhere a more design-led approach to learning and teaching practice, where teachers were finding themselves in contexts that were more technology-enabled. They were, in some ways, having to be more pragmatic and systematic about their teaching practice. So some of the discourse of design, which had previously been relevant mainly to educational software designers, was becoming relevant to the way that teachers talked about their practice. And we saw that convergence as being an interesting one, and this term design for learning rather than learning design was what we used to describe that kind of convergence of theory, practice, and the pragmatics of design. And we funded quite a lot of projects, some of them involving LAMS and Moodle and other software recourse that some of you may have used, and the pedagogic planners. And it's great that Liz is here from the Phoebe planner, and Diana obviously was speaking about the evolution of the planners this morning. So I guess some really broad and basic premises that I think we're probably all operating within were that pedagogic intention, so educational intention, can be articulated. Seems that there are people who would argue that it can't, that it's kind of something that just has to happen in the moment. But we were starting from this premise that something could be said about what teachers intend when they bring a learning situation together. And that having articulated that, it would be useful to share that articulation in some ways with other actors, maybe students, with systems, with other teachers who might want to do similar things. And those intentions could be then be enacted in real learning opportunities, but particularly that those learning opportunities might well be enabled by technical systems such as LAMS and Moodle that increasingly are part of the situation and landscape when people are learning. Now, the first phase taught us some not surprising but interesting lessons, and it's really exciting to see that a lot of the work that the OU are doing are kind of enriching and reaffirming these lessons from practice, if you like. And it's not surprising to any of us to know that design practice is very varied. We had a question from Patrick in the last session: how many design approaches are there? And somebody said an infinite number. Well, if you're a practitioner, you almost certainly do think there are an infinite number, and that yours are very, very special and different from anybody else's. There's lots of cultures of design. There's personal style involved. And of course, as we enact designs with learners, we have to be responsive and contingent as well. So it's very difficult to create tools to support something which is so diverse and emergent as design and as teaching. And perhaps because of that, the tools that we offered to practitioners were rarely experienced by them as being as flexible or pedagogically neutral as they would like, which I think is not a surprise and not a problem, but just highlights the difference between the nature of design tools and the nature of design practice. very importantly, and CloudWorks is a great example of responding to this observation and understanding, design tools must allow for collaboration. Most situations of design in further and higher education are inherently collaborative. Designs that are inherited by teachers in schools are usually produced highly collaboratively and then are collaborated on and adapted by teachers themselves. There has to be the possibility of being contingent and responsive in the learning situation as learners act on the design. And design processes, we certainly discovered, need to be well integrated with other institutional processes if they're going to be taken seriously. So it's no good having the best design tool in the world if it sits somewhere over there in a special lab outside of the everyday practices of the institution, that you have to go somewhere special to do it and doesn't produce outcomes that are easily integrated into or with other learning systems that are more institutionally supported. A big problem is that when practitioners talk about what they want from a design system, they have these two quite contradictory requirements. And one is for these very rich expressions of what that educational purpose was. A lot of practitioners have been through learning and teaching courses. They understand terms like constructivism. Many of them are very sophisticated in the language they use to talk about what their intentions are with their learners. And yet, at the same time, they want to be able to pick up and reuse very easily bite-sized elements of a design, a curriculum element, that they can just reuse or repurpose very quickly without having to enter into those kinds of protracted discussions about or negotiations over intention. Now, I put this slide back in after the last session because we had this question. I think a lot of you joined in with the activity about how many designs are there? How many approaches to design are there? And quite early on, we funded a study that came up with the answer 3 or 3.5. It's great when you fund really complicated studies and it says, and the answer is 3. It's like 42. And from that study, I really took away that most of these approaches, these theoretical approaches, actually have an awful lot in common. They all tend to emphasise activity. They tend to emphasise constructive alignment, which are probably terms you're all very familiar with. Feedback that learners do, and then they have feedback on what they've done or presented, and that there has to be some kind of integration. So designs have to show some kind of integration across elements of assessment, component knowledge, and outcomes, and so on. But there are important differences, and I think this comes back to the contribution I made in that session, which is what are the crucial decisions that practitioners make when they're thinking ahead about a learning situation? What are the important differences that might emerge in designs? Well, one is about the importance of other people, whether designs are intrinsically involving learners with others or whether they are not. One is about what I've called the authenticity of the activity, also called situatedness. So how far an activity simulates the situation in which learners will have to reproduce it, let's say professionally or vocationally, and how far, for reasons of safety or cognitive development, it's separated from authenticity. It's given a special protected space where things might be easier or less dangerous or more scaffolded. How far there is scaffolding and how far there's flexibility. And, of course, an issue that in learning design we're all grappling with, where is the locus of control? Whose intention is this that is being enacted? How far is it the teachers? How far is it the learners? How far do other people come into play when you talk about the locus of control? And that might the locus of control issue might appear at the assessment, at assessment, at teaching, at the whole design stage. So throughout designing, there is a question about whose intention is being enacted and represented. Now, for the rest of the time, I wanted to talk about some of the tensions that this is very much now my interpretation, but some of the tensions I felt emerged from the projects that we funded in the second phase. And what I will do, I've sort of flashed up what some of them are. What I will do is I will present what I think the kind of issue is and give you a couple of minutes to have a chat about what you think of that issue. And then I will tell you some of the things I think from the findings I found. But we can maybe that way get a bit of dialogue instead of me just standing talking for the rest of the half an hour. So, as I alluded, there is a representational problem, and all of us struggling in this area are aware that there is. And I alluded to the fact that practitioners want rather contradictory kinds of representation of their intentions about learning and teaching. Those intentions, let's say I have an intention that learners should come out with a particular learning outcome, that needs to be represented in different ways to different actors in the learning system, in the situation. And sort of to clarify that or to give that even more pointedness, we think that there's a tension between articulating designs clearly in educational terms, in that specialised language that practitioners use to talk about what they're doing, and working powerfully with designs in educational systems. So having computational representations of designs which allow you to manipulate them, to select them according to a limited set of criteria, for example. So you will recognise that there's a natural language representation going on in one, or quite a specialised natural language, and then a very systematic machine-based, standards-based representation in the other. So I wonder, all of you being people who work in this area, thinking about that tension, whether that rings true for you and whether you've encountered it in the work you're doing with learning design and how it manifests itself. If you could be find someone you're not a million miles away from, I mean geographically rather than intellectually, and share any thoughts you have about whether and how that tension is real for you, how it manifests itself. There's a tension, perhaps it's not a tension at all. I mean, I think I'm going to skip through a lot of what I had to say about this because I think, you've probably, all of you, got there already by other means. But one of the projects we funded, which was called Models for Learning, concluded that, just as Patrick is saying, really, that there isn't an obvious typology of designs or patterns, you know, the mythical 12 to 30 that I personally thought I was looking for 4 or 5 years ago, in which a finite number of meaningful intentions can be described or discerned. I think, you know, that they concluded from quite theoretical basis that that was not a useful place to go looking. But it may be that we can model some of the relationships between the design elements and how they constrain each other. It may be, as we've been saying, that we can simplify the choices. We can simplify the choices at certain choice points. And, you know, try to distinguish perhaps what some of the choices are. So where the choices are pragmatic, which I would say are kind of how constraints, how do learners need to be brought together into a context, what materials need to be there, what resources need to be there, how is the timing worked out so they can come back together at the right moments in time, the kind of three, the think, pair, share that Patrick was describing has a clear pragmatics that one moves through. And the educational questions, which sometimes are more why questions, some of those theoretical approaches are more about why are you doing this with learners? You know, what is going on for the learners? So I think we're all finding that there are solutions to that tension around not having one form of representation, but the guidance that we talked about earlier, that there might be additional forms of representation that produce those why discussions with practitioners without having to represent them in a finite or closed way. There was another dilemma which we worked with and became really quite an interesting and contentious point for the programme, and I don't know if others of you have found this, which was about really the term learning design or design for learning. So a lot of people were saying, well, what we're doing here is not learning design, it's teaching design. And people felt very uncomfortable with the ways that we were using the term learning. And there was a lot of argument within the programme about whether there was a role really for designers in learning, because we are all capable of learning and of, to some extent, influencing the environment around us to make it more conducive to our own learning. And I think the conclusion that I have drawn from looking at what the projects did is that good teaching, to use that slightly dodgy word these days, the conception and enactment of a pedagogic intention, an intention for somebody else to learn something, is not the same thing as good self-directed learning. My intention to learn something for myself, my personal learning goal. Those two things have to be clearly in dialogue with each other, but they are not the same intention, they are not the same human activity. So the tools and surfaces that support us in our teaching roles, when we have that intention towards other people to learn, may not be the same tools that support us when we are acting only as learners, when we're fulfilling our own personal learning goals. Just as the skills are different, but need to develop in dialogue. So I guess if you agree with me, and there may be people here who don't agree with that point, and I'm quite aware that it's a contentious point. But if you agree with me that different tools are required by teachers and learners, but they must be very closely in dialogue with each other, well, then the question becomes, what is the nature of that dialogue? And what are the points of intersection between learners' and teachers' intentions and the points of intersection between the tools and services they're using? Now, slightly more puzzlement, I think, at that dilemma. Can I leave that with you for a minute or so again to decide whether that is a dilemma in the field you're working in? Is that a dilemma for learning design, or is that really an issue that we can say is solved and is okay? Do you have answers to this question about how and when the intentions of teachers and learners intersect, and how that can be made, how those intersections can be made more transparent to one another, perhaps, when they do meet? Can I leave that with you for a couple of minutes to discuss again and come back? I'm hearing a bit of a lull again, or I'm trying to imagine one, in the interest of finishing in time for the end of the session. Can I just see if there's anyone who has anything pressing to say about the learning-teaching dilemma? Is there any consensus that there is a dilemma here or a tension that we need to be aware of? Di, yes, please.
Yes, well, there's a consensus of two. I was saying that I think underneath the tools and services issue, that even if we just set aside all the issues of infrastructure, tools and services, we just talked about teaching and learning. If we just set aside all the services and tools, then we would still find that there was a dilemma. And the dilemma is to do with, are you thinking in terms of you're a cognitive surgeon who's intervening in the head of the learner so that they acquire the knowledge which you've got? Or are you somebody who's setting out and articulating a domain of knowledge which the learner knows nothing about and they need some signposts so that they know something about the verb structure in Arabic or whatever it is? Or are you engaged in some enterprise where you're together exploring some area which you don't know about, which maybe the learner is the expert in? You're trying to transform their work environment or improve something that's going on in their intervention in the world, in which case you certainly are going to be in the situation where the inverted commas learner is the person who's somebody who needs to be engaged in the design process that you're engaged in. And unless we have some kind of clarity about those different contexts, then getting some clarity about the tools that we're building to support those actors is going to be really, really hard. So it was an interesting question to think about, but because that's what it made me realise, is that we can't make a statement about the tools and the infrastructure without the context.
So does that imply that the perhaps misguided attempt to describe a limited number of approaches would better be an attempt to describe a limited number of contexts or a limited number of types of learning and teaching relationship?
I think relationship is a key concept, here. So I was kind of thinking about, what is it, what kind of tools might support a genuinely partnership or collaborative model based on, as you say, sort of shared inquiry around drawing on shared practices of inquiry. So from that perspective, I was thinking, so why would learners and teachers use different tools? They're using the same methodologies, research methodologies or inquiry processes and so on. Why would they use different tools? On the other hand, I kind of thought, actually, isn't there also a conundrum here in terms of thinking about transferring inquiry processes into the learning and teaching context, in that what kind of tools do many teachers use to conduct their own inquiries as sophisticated, advanced inquiries in their fields? Maybe in some discipline areas that's much clearer than in others.
So it may be that there's an overlap, that there are tools for digital scholarship which should be shared, ideally should be shared as much as possible in the middle section of
something like that, yes.
Okay. You'll be pleased to know there's only a couple more of these. And then we can go to coffee. But I haven't any answers here. I'm just throwing these questions out for you. Yes, certainly in terms of the Pedagogic Planner project that the DISC funded, there was very clearly a tension between the urge to model, and when I say model, I don't necessarily mean computationally model, but I mean guide, provide software that nudges people down certain routes towards what we as designers might consider to be good design, and offering very open-ended tools for educators to construct and express their own pedagogic intentions, however random we might think those intentions might be. And clearly there is a lot of open water between those two, and I guess what most of us are trying to do at this point in time is down at the bottom, which is to create some kind of visualization or articulation tool which helps to articulate what an intention might be and carries design messages while still remaining relatively neutral and sort of open-ended towards exactly how that's carried out. But I mean, I think I go back to Di's and Phil's point about there being very different contexts for teaching and learning, in some of which, you know, different tools might be entirely appropriate. You can't just take the whole load. The last sort of point, which I think I wanted to just spend a couple of minutes on, because for me, towards the end of the time of the Design for Learning programme, sort of 2007-2008, this was coming up more and more as we talked about what we had set out to do and what we felt we had achieved. Web 2 was, you know, suddenly what everyone was using for teaching and learning. And it seemed to me that this actually was a fairly fundamental challenge, not just to a lot of the premises we'd had in 2005 at the start of Design for Learning, but actually to what we think we're doing in the classroom as educators at all. Because, as we know, Web 2 completely reconfigures the user, or the learner in this case, as someone who determines their own purposes and values and meanings around all kinds of knowledge and learning that they might find, share, recreate, repurpose and discover. And that seems to me, and to a lot of people who've coined the phrase learning 2.0, to represent certain challenges to the idea of curriculum, to the idea of learning activity design, as predetermining a process, a situation, a context, when we know that a lot of the time learners are already blending their own learning situations, blending their own curricula, if you like, and sharing them with other people. So we have, sorry, my PowerPoint slide made on a Mac, translated to PC, is not working very well. But there's a distinction between what we might call orchestrating technologies and an orchestrating approach to the curriculum, where you have VLEs and learner management systems, you have courses and modules as a kind of base unit of pedagogic intention. You focus on the purposes of the designer, what are the learning outcomes that you've written down at the beginning of your curriculum or your session. There's a sort of top-down management of the learning process as against a kind of aggregating technical environment, where learners are able to reuse very small-scale elements of the curriculum for their own purposes. And that the kind of knowledge practices you find on the web, but the background there is the designs we collected, or Sheila sitting over there, collected from the Design for Learning programme as a delicious resource, obviously kind of capable of being re-aggregated in as many ways as people want to. And that's a kind of example of how the Web 2 knowledge practice refuses any kind of finished curriculum or final order. So these designs we've collated are not homogeneous, they are not standardized, they are not all LAMS sequences, for example. They are tagged, so they pass on a fragment of sense that the original designer had of what the purposes were to a new user. But it is only that fragment of sense. The new users are left, whether they're learners or teachers, to make sense of them again in a new context. And this approach does seem to me to present some challenges to us, and the notion of designing learning situations or learning designs. So to finish with that thought, design is a contested space, as we know, and however, there is a continued need, as we found through the uptake of the tools that we'd developed, there's a continued need for well-designed tools to support the teaching process, closely aligned with tools that support learning, and in some cases the same tool. Contingency and collaboration, as we know, are kind of key features of the process, and designs and design tools have to afford both of those if they're going to be acceptable to teachers and to learners. Of course, we know there isn't one tool that can resolve all the conflicting requirements, and we know that the tools can interoperate in useful ways. But I think the dilemma about learning and teaching, and the dilemma about the Web 2 environment, creating learners as designers of their own learning environments, helps us to remember that we have to put learners progressively more in control of their own learning as we design. So I think we resolve the tension around teaching and learning by saying learners are capable progressively of becoming learner-centred designers of their own learning, but we mustn't assume at the outset that they are. And that's kind of a message that came quite strongly out of the programme. And I think there's a couple of minutes for any questions or thoughts about those dilemmas. Or if none, then time for me to put my hat on as Sarah and say that JISC has launched a publication which was partly inspired by the Design for Learning programme and many other projects called Effective Practice in a Digital Age, which has a series of case studies of teachers and learners using technology collaboratively to create new learning situations, and also includes some elements of the kind of background of Design for Learning that I've alluded to. And you can find that, I think you should have had a copy of that when you arrived, which if you want to discuss with me or any of the presentation, I should be around during coffee and before the next session. It's Effective Practice in the Digital Age, but there's lots of copies on the table outside, so you can just take one away. They're freely available. And there's also details in there of the programmes that JISC is now funding in this area if you have any interest. Di.
I've got the microphone, so, you know, there we go. I'm very interested in this. In the Web 2, we don't need teachers anymore position.
I'm not saying I agree with it.
Part of it is very attractive to me. You know, I didn't much enjoy my school experience. From that, the whole free schools generation, and it all sounds kind of right, the whole de-schooling thing. I found myself drawn to saying no, it's not like that. And I think what's interesting about it is that it does push me into, and I think others, into defending the teaching profession. And thinking about what it is that we do that's really valuable. I think the assumptions that underlie it, that we can all look at this material that's out there and learn, which is probably actually what most of us here actually do. You know, we've all got sort of degrees and so forth. We can go into Delicious, we can sort it out, we can learn. I'm afraid that it's going to make for a tremendous disempowerment of lots of people, and it focuses my mind on the teacher's role in empowering, and the kind of structures that we make for empowering. Now it's a bit off the topic, but you raised that there. So in a way, it's a challenge to us to say, well, what are actually the things that make a difference that we can do? Forgetting about the national curriculum, forgetting about what we need to do in our jobs, but what do we actually need to do to intervene to make it possible for that to turn into a real learning experience for people who have a need to transform themselves? In the silence, I get to say that.
I'm not sure it is off the topic, because I think when we talk about what kinds of tools we want to use, what kinds of designs we want to share, we have to talk at some level about the kind of values we have around teaching. So I don't think it is off the topic. And anyone else want to come in on that?
You said it's kind of disempowering, but it's also potentially empowering, because there's a monopoly on the curriculum at the moment, which is kind of controlled by higher education. It says, and that's often limited by what's financially viable. And, you know, it's all the kind of thing, once you open it up to the masses, you can go beyond what's financially viable. So there's a kind of liberation of the curriculum, if you like. And if you're interested in, you know, the history of Cardiff Football Club, which, you know, you're probably not going to find a higher education course there, but you might find someone constructs a really nice set of resources and perhaps binds them up with, you know, activities that you do online. So it's also potentially very empowering, because people who feel disenfranchised by a very closed curriculum will suddenly find that there are lots of things out there, and there are lots of people who can help them learn it and stuff. So, but you're absolutely right, but it helps us define the role of the teacher, and it certainly, of the many components or roles that a teacher does, it some of them become weaker to attack, if you like, than others, and providing content is one of those. So you don't really need to be the person who provides all the content anymore. You know, if people can go to iTunes U and get a lecture, then why be in Bournemouth University getting a lecture, you know? So it's not about the content, but about the structure around it.
I would agree with all of that. I'm just And for me, it's been transforming, you know, to have access to all this stuff. It's made it possible for me to have the kind of career that I've had, and it's been great. But I am worried that if we just go with that, then we might not be happy with what actually happened, comes out of it, because we're making all kinds of assumptions about the way that people are interacting with that. But, yeah, I think we're on the same page there.
Well, one way we might define the formal as opposed to informal learning would be that it's where learners have a personal goal which they actually can't achieve simply by doing the more obvious learning activities of going and finding the knowledge they need and acting on it. You know, whereas educators, we might actually have the knowledge that in order to get over there, you might have to go over there and over there and over there and over there and do some things that feel personally very challenging, but it will be worth it because at the end of it, you will arrive where you want to. So that may be a good way of distinguishing, because I think everything has, informal learning is in danger of taking over everything, because you know it seems to be the flavour of the month, where we might actually use some of the ideas around learning design to articulate what it is that formal learning is about that's different from that, and therefore what the role of a clearly articulated pedagogic intention and pathway can be to help learners achieve their personal goals in ways that are not achievable by them on their own.
I've still got the microphone.
But maybe James should have it now.
Good, you'll go.
I think one of the challenges we have is that, for me, the ideal teacher is one who knows the path ahead of me as a novice learner, who not only understands the content, but the typical learning challenges and the wrong paths one can take in trying to understand something. And so hopefully they're kind of a few steps ahead of you, helping to guide you, to suggest, to offer ways to find your way in that learning, which you don't have if you try and do it all on your own. And so it's their expertise of, you know, being a mentor and expert in the area, which is the part of teaching that I think has got so much value. The downside is that certainly in universities, many of our experts have become so expert in their content knowledge that they actually find it hard to imagine what it's like to be a novice learner again. And so the very expertise they have may be not even just neutral, but in fact a barrier to helping the novice learner find their way in that area. And so that seems to be quite a struggle we have, that we have an ideal of what we'd like a teacher to be. But in higher ed, I think in many cases, the sheer narrowness and depth of expertise itself can sometimes be not helpful to scaffolding a novice learner to find their way in that discipline.
And maybe some of those conversations which can be triggered by offering those discrete choices that we talked about in the session before actually are productive in moving those content experts towards being more effective teachers as well. I think we've overshot at this point, so I'll say thank you for joining in, and I'm around if you want to talk about the actual content of some of these projects in more detail as well. Thank you.
Thank you.